Well, I get pig-headed and I drink too much. I'm out of state and I'm out of touch. Got a reckless heart and a beggar's knee. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Well, I don't say much, but I love to talk. Got a funny way and a funny walk. Got a point of view that's hard to see. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. It's a hard story with soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced. Poor bookmark, there's a bottle, so I don't lose my place.
You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear my interview with Stephen Axelrod, author of Nantucket Grand, the third in his Henry Kennis Mysteries, published by Poison Pen Press. I met Stephen Axelrod when he was a student in the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Writing program, and right away I knew he was the real deal. He knew his way around authors and around books, both literary and popular. He'd worked as a Hollywood screenwriter and had a WGA union card to prove it. Most of all, he was a natural storyteller who laid it all out there with humor, insight, and impeccable timing. It's been a little surprise to me then to watch Axelrod's writing career take off. He had a long run at Salon.com and Open Salon, where he wrote about books, films, and politics, and at the online literary magazine Numero Cinq. His noir fiction has appeared in Pulp Modern, Big Pulp, and Hollywood Dementia, and his Henry Kennis series, set on the island of Nantucket, has been garnering great reviews. In my interview with Stephen Axelrod, we talked about development pressure and the influence of immigration on Nantucket, Henry Kennis's pursuit of a cold-blooded killer, and why, when it comes to writing mysteries, some clues are just better than others. Stephen Axelrod, thanks for being a guest on Write the Book.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Nantucket Grand is your latest book. It's a Henry Kennis mystery, and it's just out on Poison Pen Press. It's the third of the Henry Kennis mysteries, and for those of us who are kind of new to the game, I was wondering if you could just read a little bit to give us a taste of the book.
Sure. I'm going to read a part that's fairly well into the book. All you really need to know is that a lot of strange things have been happening. A house burned down, a kid drowned, another kid OD'd on drugs. There was a murder that at first looked like a hunting accident. Completely disconnected, random events. But Henry, my hero, who writes poetry, now has a girlfriend who actually writes cozy mysteries, and in his Jane style. They met at a reading, actually, where he was reading a poem and she was reading one of her mysteries. And they've sort of taken up with each other. And hopefully now, after some misfires romantically, Henry now has a steady girlfriend, and I'm hoping she'll be a kind of Nick and Nora Charles type of deal. They can solve things together. And she bears an eerie resemblance to my girlfriend. I don't know. Entirely coincidental. We met exactly the same way at a reading, and everything. The only difference is what she writes. My girlfriend writes sublime literary fiction, and Jane writes silly cozy mysteries. But the cozy mysteries, Robin, sort of comment on the genre. See, Henry doesn't know he's in a mystery novel, so he thinks, okay, well, you'll see. So here's this. This is from chapter 27.
Okay.
There's a lot more going on than meets the eye, Jane said. There always is. There has to be. I shook my head, exhaling a quiet laugh. In your books, you mean? She gave me a stern look. Life imitates art, not in police work. I told you all the different crimes this year were connected, and you didn't believe me then either, but it was true. Fair enough. But now you're saying they're connected two ways, which frankly gives me a headache tonight. I have no idea what the second one could be. But you have to find out, because that's the really important question. That's the one someone's hiding. And Daisy's the key to it. We were eating ice cream cones. I had driven out to Pulpus with sandwiches in hand, but all either of us wanted was a treat. It was a perfect early summer night, and we drove to Sconset Market for a couple of overpriced scoops. The ice cream was good, and the market hadn't changed at all in decades. It was a pleasant excursion, driving along the eastern edge of the island, skirting Sacagawea Pond, cutting through the old Sankaty Head golf course, then running parallel to the bluffs of Baxter Road into the little village. We strolled out into the center of Sconset, which consisted of a small rotary, two restaurants, a liquor store, the post office, and the market, with a little rectangle of park beside it. Kids were cruising by on bikes, and you could see the rich people had already started to arrive for the season, tall and handsome and blonde, with perfectly dressed kids and great hair, talking about tennis dates and tea times and Muffy's divorce. Jane pointed at two big blondes in tennis clothes climbing out of a Lexus SUV. "Look at that hair," she whispered to me. "If I had that hair, I'd be driving that Lexus." "But you don't want a Lexus." "It's not the point. I could have whatever I wanted with hair like that. I mean, what else do they have going for them?" "They're pretty." "Oh, they're okay looking. Really check them out." I did. She was right. Regular, ordinary features. The bodies weren't much better. "They have some cellulite happening. And they're not bright either," she said. "I wouldn't exactly call that a high watermark in political discourse." She nodded toward one of the kids scampering by in a "John Kerry for President of France" t-shirt. I nodded. "Someone bought him that item." "Yeah, someone bought it for his big brother and kept it for the next kid." "Dumb and sentimental, great combination." "Doesn't matter, she's got the hair." We strolled back to the car and waited online, drove down under the pedestrian bridge to look at the water. An old Volkswagen Beetle drove by, powder blue convertible, 1970s vintage. "That's the car I want," Jane said. "Nice. Just reminds me of, I used to drive one of those, I loved it." "I'm not sure you need world-class hair to get an old bug." "Yeah, maybe not, but my ex-husband was a mechanic in the family. His idea of a fun Sunday afternoon was climbing into the car to replace the solenoid, whatever that is. I don't think cars even have them anymore." We drove back to Pulpus, took turns eating our sandwiches, turkey terrifics from Provisions, and reading aloud. So, Jane assembles her papers. In the recent installments of her new Maddie Clark novel, Poverty Point, Maddie had searched the house where the murder took place after the police, under the inept leadership of Police Chief Bill Bloat, turned the place upside down and found nothing. Maddie, with her tireless ant-like industry and the patience of a fly fisherman, had dug out a broken bracelet from the crack between the two wide floorboards. "I stole that from you," Jane confessed, "the hair clip, tit for tat." Anyway, Maddie instantly recognized the double pyramid slashed vertically by a cursive capital S, because Maddie's ex-husband, like Jane's, had been a Scientologist for many years. Jane's ex had left the church in disgust when he finally found out the details of its wacky theology, but Maddie's remained stalwart. Chief Bloat showed zero interest in this new evidence, of course. The man wouldn't recognize an elephant if it was stepping on his foot. Bloat's view, the bracelet could have been there for years, could have belonged to anyone, could even have been placed there to throw the police off the scent. "Ah, but then he'd have to assume you'd find it," Maddie said sweetly. As always happened in Jane's books, the blundering, pompous clowns who made up a Nantucket police department arrested the wrong person. The evidence was circumstantial, the eyewitness was a drunk. But there was nothing Maddie could do about it. She had no suspect of her own. Until she did some last-minute marketing. Here's the end of the chapter she read me. After weeks of false leads and dead ends, red herrings and rotten bluefish, as Maddie called them, she finally solved the puzzle of Raymond Scully's murder in a single moment, driving into the Stop and Shop parking lot. As usual, she was cruising the crowded tarmac, trying to find a spot closest to the store. She could walk for hours when she was in the mood, but she hated any unnecessary exercise and dreaded seeing people she knew among the cars and shopping carts. They were all people she didn't like and acquaintances who would invariably want to catch up. But the worst were the old friends who insisted on having actual conversations in the canned goods aisle. You could lose an hour or two in the soul-sapping fluorescent light, listening to someone's divorce update or the tribulations of the Whalers' last road trip. Maddie was on her third circuit when she saw Bradley Morell wheeling a cart full of grocery bags to his car. An artist who specialized in seagulls, sailboats at anchor, and cobblestone street scenes, Bradley was always talking about moving to New York where his real work, messy abstraction in mud brown and exhaust purple, would be taken seriously. Of course, he never left. Nantucket was the capital city of procrastination. It ate away at people's ambitions like powder-post beetles chewing away at an old house. everyone was going to write that book, use all that sound equipment in their basement to finally cut a demo record, get a portfolio of their photographs together after the summer season next year on the first of Never. It didn't matter to Bradley Morrell. He was a trust fund baby who could afford to indulge his airs and affectations. He was normally quite useless, but he was going to come in handy today. Maddie could take his parking space. She idled the car, watching him. He lifted the hatchback of his SUV and started loading in the paper bags. His cell phone rang, and distracted for a second, he banged his head on the sharp edge of the raised panel. He grunted in pain, closed his eyes, and moved his forehead up to touch the exact spot where he'd clouded himself. Maddie gasped. The real thing, inhaling so hard, breath scraped in her throat. She knew that gesture very well. Derek had done it all the time. It was called contact assist, a technique for dealing with injuries developed by L. Ron Hubbard in the 1960s. Brady Morrell was a Scientologist. She had his clear bracelet in her pocket. She stared at him as he finished loading his car. She knew Brady was the killer now. All she had to do was prove it.
Wow, that's great. Thank you.
I love that. I'm tempted to actually write some Jane Stiles books. I think that would really be fun.
Yeah.
That's meta, boy.
Yeah. I love that Henry.
I don't know what name I'd publish them under. Poverty Point by Stephen Axelrod, a Jane Stiles novel, or by Jane Stiles or Stephen Axelrod. I don't know. It's too confusing.
Yeah, yeah.
My editor loves the idea.
Wow, that's great.
Anyway,
good for you.
Fun. Clues.
You know, one of the things that you know is really evident in that passage that you read is the world of Nantucket, which I think is one of the things that probably really hooks people on this series. And I realize I don't really know that much about it. Is there kind of a general rundown you can give me of, you know, Nantucket and life on Nantucket?
Well, sure. I think, first of all, I mean, the main thing people know about Nantucket from is Wings, the television show, which literally had nothing to do with the island whatsoever. It's amazing. They did some aerial shots of it in the credit sequence, but otherwise it was completely... They almost arrogantly got everything wrong about the island, which
right.
is frustrating. First of all, I think the main thing for my books is you have to realize is that of the 400 people who own half of America, about 312 of them are here every August.
Wow.
It is an unbelievable world of the one percenters, and at the same time, to service them, there's a huge number of poor people, mostly immigrants. And I'm talking about immigrants from everywhere. It's like the whaling days. Immigrants from Belarus and Chechnya and Jamaica and Ireland and Ecuador and everywhere in between who come looking for the, you know, quick money. And it's kind of like a plantation economy, really, because, you know, slaves got enough to eat and a place to live, and that was it. And if you live on Nantucket, the money you get paid is pretty much enough to give you a place to live and food.
Right.
So I'm not. It's a little hazy there. So there's a real kind of class war going on. Actually, it's not really a war because the upper class won it decisively. One thing that I mentioned in the books is we built a huge new police station. It's gigantic. We call it Valhalla. Well, beside you. And, you know, and you cannot drive on the island now for more than 10 minutes without three cop cars passing you. The police presence is eerie and bizarre. And partly it's because, you know, there's this huge underclass now. It's a huge underclass on Nantucket that, you know, most of them don't speak English. In fact, when they get a police call, they don't even know what language they're hearing it in. They literally have no idea what they're hearing. It could be Portuguese, it could be Belarus, it could be Spanish, it could be, you know, it could be Arabic, it could be anything. And so when people go to, when the cops answer police calls here, they have, it could be like anything from a bird trapped in the living room to a domestic abuse to a robbery to a fire. There's just no way to know. So they have to go to every minor distress call, every 911 call, ready to, like, fight a war. It's really weird. It's very strange. There's like translators in the court. There's like three. There's a Portuguese and a Russian and a Spanish translator in court. You know, most of the people you just pass in the street don't speak English. And it's weird. It has a strange quality to it. And the island as it used to be, the island Jane Stiles remembers, that Annie remembers, that my girlfriend my girlfriend, her family has been here 150 years, you know. Her grandfather started the yacht club. It was a New York yacht club. It was a little offspring of the New York yacht club at the time. He was the first commodore of the new Nantucket yacht club. So, I mean, they've been like the ruling class of Nantucket for generations, and she's watched the island change, you know, and it's changed a lot. And it's now a real hotbed of this kind of all this, these racial tensions and economic tensions. It's kind of a good small cameo of America. So it makes it fun to write about.
Yeah, I was kind of reminded, I don't know if you've read the Henning Mankell's books.
I know of them.
Yeah, I would recommend them. They're fantastic. And it's, you know, Inspector Kurt Vollander.
There's a TV show.
Yeah, correct. The TV show's okay, I think. The books are fantastic. But a lot of what is happening in Vollander's novels is the effect of immigration on Sweden.
That's very parallel to you, because this place was, you know, completely lily white backwater for years. I mean, there was never any immigration of any kind. And right now, somebody told me, a cop told me this, that this is one of the number one entry points for illegal immigrants in the country.
Really?
Nantucket. Yeah.
Surprising.
It is surprising.
Because no one pays attention to it, maybe it's an attractive option.
Yeah, well, it's just you can make a lot of money fast. You know what I mean? I mean, the people I'm competing with as a painter, which is what I do in my actual life, you know, they sleep 10 in a room, they pay no taxes, they pay no insurance, they don't have a workman's compensation. They have no real expenses. In fact, I was driving around the Rotary the other day, and we saw two Ecuadorian guys, I guess, who were on bikes, and they had a 40-foot ladder, and one guy had the front of the ladder, and the other guy had the back of the ladder, and they were riding, they were carrying this ladder on their bicycles.
Wow, that's an image.
And I turned to my friend, and I said, you know, I can't compete with that. You know, I can't compete with that.
Yeah.
You know, you go to bid a job that's a $30,000 job, you bid it at $25,000 because you know that the competition is stiff, and some other guy who has no expenses is bid $10,000.
Right.
You know, so it's like, it's tough. So you have to bid $10,000, and you can do the job for $10,000, but you make no money. And then, again, you're in that slave situation where you're just working just to put food on the table and pay your rent, you know.
Right.
And the rents are skyrocketing here. So
sure.
It's getting harder and harder to live on Nantucket, and less pleasant to live here.
Yeah, I can feel that in the books. So into this all, you've placed Henry Kennis, and he's a former L.A. cop. But what I really like about him is that you play him against stereotype. You know, if you say the phrase L.A. cop to anyone who's, you know, read Raymond Chandler or seen the kind of noir films of the, you know,
or followed the Rampart scandals or whatever. I mean,
or seen the Rodney King video, you know, you have this image in your mind of just a simply brutal, corrupt human being, and yet Henry's not that. In fact, he spends a fair amount of his time trying to stop other law enforcement people from behaving like L.A. cops, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. I was in L.A. a few years ago, quite a few, about 15 years ago, and I was visiting someone who lived in Pasadena. I was driving back from Pasadena to my mother's house in Westwood, in West Los Angeles, and it was late at night. I wasn't drunk, but I was tired, and it was late at night, and they do road work in L.A. at night, because the only time they can do it, because if you did road work in the day, if you close one lane of traffic in the daytime, you'd like back up everything for 1,000 miles and cripple the city. So they do all the road work at night. So I'm sort of moving my car through this maze of weird lights and guys with flares and stuff, and I managed to do it. But siren behind me, the back of my car was flooded with light. I was taken off the highway into this little weird cul-de-sac by these two cops. And I'm like, you know, I have all the cliches in my head that everyone else
right.
does. I mean, these guys could, like, kill me if they wanted to. Like, no one knows I'm here. And the guys come out, and they made me do the drunk test. You know, I do this, I'm not drunk. And they say, so what's going on? You know, and I explain that I'm from Nantucket, and I was confused by the road work. And they were like, are you tired? Do you want to get some coffee? And like I said, actually a sedative would be good right now. I'm pretty wired. Talking to two cops in a dark road, I'm pretty wired. And they were so incredible, and you know, they were so incredibly nice and charming and businesslike and professional and considerate that I actually wrote a letter to their police station, and which apparently got framed and still sitting there, just saying how much I appreciated that. So, you know, not all cops are bad cops, and those cops were particular. There was a Filipino guy and a black guy, the two who stopped pulling me over, and they were both like perfect. So I do want to, my son said something interesting too once a while ago. He said that it seemed to him that police work draws the best people and the worst people, but not much in between.
Yeah.
And I want Henry to be one of the best. One thing my girlfriend said to me when I started this project was, she said, Henry will never succeed because he's not screwed up enough. He's not a drug addict. He's not alcoholic. He doesn't have all these horrible divorces. He doesn't have a gambling addiction. You got to give him a dark side. But I didn't want to do that. I don't have a dark side that way. I don't see why Henry had to have a dark side. You know, his dark side consists of, you know, mulling the moral ramifications of what he's doing. In the first book, he has the opportunity to really take the law into his own hands. He solved the case and no one else has. And he could actually arrange things so everyone came out well, or so justice was served according to his lights, if he wanted to. But he realizes that he can't do that. That he, you know, that he's not like the king of anything. He's just a little ant scurrying around at the base of this gigantic pillar, which is the law, you know, and it's not his place to play God with people, so he doesn't. But it's interesting because I wrote that scene with him actually playing God, and we read it in my little writer's group at the time, and one of my best friends, who's a poet, who was in the group, who's actually died recently, unfortunately, he made all the arguments against it that actually Henry goes through in his own head. The argument we had that night, I have Henry having something with himself in the book, and it sort of set the tone for him really wrestling with the moral dimension of being a cop, because having that power is a little, it can set you askew, I think. You know, I mean, it obviously does. I'm going to have more of that.
I love that about Henry. I love the way he's so tender toward his children. And he actually, in this book, he faces a dilemma. He's offered a job, you know, off-island for more money, and he's really struggling with that.
Yeah, well, you know, now again, it's also, I tried to keep Henry and my lives pretty parallel.
Uh-huh.
Years ago, when my kids were the age that Henry's are. Henry's like 20 years younger than me, much better looking and much smarter. But when our kids were the same age, I wrote a Spec Friends episode. I was dating at the time a girl who was who was the chief financial officer of a major talent agency in Hollywood. And she gave that spec script to the agent who like handled all the Friends writers. They handled all the writers for Friends. And the guy called me back and said, you know, we're on. It's the best spec script I've read in 10 years. I love it. All I need is your new contact information. And I was like, what do you mean? I don't have new contact information. He's like, well, when are you moving out here? I'm like, moving out there? Well, you can't do this from there. When are you coming? And I'm like, I'm not. My son was really in a delicate phase at that point, really delicate. He could have gone either way. His uncle committed suicide. There was a lot of craziness in the family, and I saw him really teetering. There was no way I was going to be writing some, you know, sitcom while my son was doing a nosedive. So I just said no. You know, the guy was furious at me. He said, "All my clients want to be my clients. You know, I can't have a client who doesn't want to be my client." He got really pissed off and hung up on me, and that was the end of that. And for a long time, I felt really bad about it. I felt like my kids were screwing up my life. And the exact scene that described in the book happened, where my daughter had a horrible stomach flu. And I got her out of bed, and she was puking, projectile vomiting all over the downstairs bathroom. And I got her back up, cleaned her up, and got her back to bed. And went downstairs, and I was cleaning her puke off the walls. And I had this fantastic epiphany that this is what I wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I needed to be. And I'd much rather be cleaning my daughter's puke off the walls at 3 a.m. than writing a sitcom somewhere else, you know. Yeah. So I gave Henry that exact moment except a different situation, but the same, you know, the emotional truth of it is the same. It's going to be fun too, because the kids are going to grow up and get into their nightmarish teens. And, you know, Jane and he are going to move in together, and, you know, she's going to have to deal with their nightmarish teenage years the way Annie had to deal with my kids' nightmarish teenage years. So that's the fun about writing a series. You can just, continue right. these things. And if like someone picks up book 6 or something, and Jane's having her war with Henry's son about his messiness, which actually happened. And he actually won the war of Nick's messiness and turned him into a neat kid, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing. I don't know how she did that, but I'm going to have to revisit it for the book when I get there. But, you know, if you read that and you're interested, you can all go all the way back to when the kids were 9 and 10 years
sure.
old and see, or the first day, if you're interested, you know, when he and Jane met or whatever. So there's all the characters are going to sort of have this through line. That's what Robert B. Parker did so well. You know, he'll have a book where he is supposed to find this kid, and he finds the kid, but the parents are horrible. So instead of taking the kid back to the parents, he takes the kid up to Maine to build a house with him. He knows building and fighting, and he teaches the kid those two things. And that kid becomes his friend, and Paul Jacomin, he's a ballet dancer who, like, all through all the Spencer books, as he grows up and hits adulthood, and they stay friends, you know. It's kind of great. So Spencer constantly developed an ever-growing group of, like, friends and acquaintances that would be introduced in one book, and, you know, you'd see them in later books. It was kind of neat. I want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I like Mankell, too. He does that you know, human story really well across a bunch of books.
Yeah, well, that's the business plan of Poison Pen Press. They only publish series, and they run a bookstore in Scottsdale. I mean, they ran the bookstore for years before they started publishing books. And they used the bookstore as kind of a laboratory, and they just watched the way people bought books. And they saw that people bought series, that people got hooked by a series and wanted to know, you know, what was happening, like updates on the characters as well as
right.
the plots, you know. And so that's all they published. They just published series. And they've carved quite a little niche for themselves. You know, they're a small publishing house, but they're completely independent. And my editor, whose name is Annette Rogers, shout out to Annette, you know, she's incredibly stringent. It's like getting a high school paperback. You know, I sort of go into the, it's like actually, I don't know, many of your listeners will recognize this, but it's kind of like getting a packet back from Doug Glover, quite honestly, from one of our more stringent professors at Vermont College of Fine Arts, who was lovingly nicknamed the Shredder by his students.
Yes, I've been shredded by Doug Glover, and it's an experience, but it's a worthwhile one.
It is worthwhile. And the same thing with Annette. I mean, I just, you get these pages back and you're like, oh my, you see me, you kind of a fetal position for 2 days whimpering before you actually deal with the editorial letters. But she's always right. Like, and then I'll give you an example. The book I'm writing right now, I thought I'd do a Christmas book, kind of a lighthearted Christmas mystery. We have a red tickets drawing. Every time you buy something more than $20 here, you get a red ticket, and you collect them and you go to Main Street on Christmas Eve and I do a big drawing and someone wins $10,000. And I thought, well, maybe I'll have some kids figure a way to, like, rig the drawing. You know, that'll be sort of a fun, lighthearted crime. So I sent her, I was unemployed this winter. I wrote, like, 200 pages of it. So I sent it to her, and she calls me back and says, where's the dead body? I'm like, no, there's no dead body. It's Christmas. It's fun. It's lighthearted. She says, oh, that's great. Good. Christmas, lighthearted, fun, dead body. So Annie said, it could be a cold case. You know, it doesn't have to be a new dead body. And then it was interesting, that really struck a chord between the two of them, because part of what I'm doing is I always have kind of an awful rich person, evil character in the books. That's sort of become a trademark. And the guy in the new book, I want him to be Scrooge, since it's a Christmas story. I want it to I want to do Christmas Carol with no supernatural element. So I needed a ghost of Christmas, past, present, and future that had nothing to do with ghosts. So I needed a horrible thing in his past, a terrible thing he's doing in the present, and a nightmarish future. And I realized that this skeleton could literally be the skeleton in his closet, and it could be the ghost of Christmas past for my Scrooge character. And that's kind of the way things work with Annette. You know, she'll make some statement like that, and it gets me thinking, and it's hugely helpful. So, I mean, that's the thing about about self-publishing that I have to say, there's so many reasons why I think it's a bad idea, but one of the main things is the editing process. You can hire an editor, but you can also fire an editor, and you don't have to listen to your editor. I have to listen to Annette. She's my boss. I'm not her boss. If we come to a point where we can't agree, I can either do what she says anyway or walk. You know, it's like, it's a pretty rigorous, inflexible relationship, you know. And she's great, and we have never gotten to that point. But the fact that that's the truth means I have to take her her criticisms much more seriously. And I have to adapt myself to what she's saying. And she knows what she's talking about. And every time I've ever done that, it's been for the better. And I just know if I had hired her as an editor, I would have said, you're fired. I don't have to do that.
Right.
I'm going to get an editor who likes all my stuff, you know. So I really think that that's a huge part of it. I really need editing and have an editor like, you know, in big publishing houses, you don't get this kind of editing attention either. You know, Poison Pen really, I mean, you get edited. You get seriously edited. I'm talking about line by line.
It shows.
I have an editor who hates the word just. I don't know how you feel about the word just, but she hates it. I'll write a sentence. He was just 20 minutes late, you know, line through it. He was 20 minutes late. He just doesn't understand. He doesn't understand.
Maybe you can develop a software application that will automatically delete that word.
Yeah, I sort of got one in my head now. I never use the word just anymore.
You know, you've just ruined me. I'm never going to be able to use that word again in writing. And you can pass that on to Annette. You know, in Nantucket Grand, Henry has uncovered something extremely unsavory, and something that you might not think would be happening in such a Tony vacation spot as Nantucket.
Well, skirting on the far edges of a lawsuit,
yeah.
I can tell you that something similar, though not exactly like what happens in the book, actually happened some time ago here.
Yeah. And I don't want to give too much away, but I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about the, you know, the crime itself.
Well, but the thing you have to realize about Nantucket is we are in the midst of a major opioid epidemic, just like you are,
right,
in Vermont. And it's amazing, you know. There's like gangs who are selling opioids now. I mean, it's like a serious crime problem, and you know, when you have drugs, you have drug whores, you know. I mean, it just, people can pay for drugs lots of different ways. And some of them are less savory than others, and they're not all, a lot of it's barter, let's put it that way. And we've had that here. It's a little known but true thing. And I tried to make all the particulars different because I didn't want to, you know, point the finger at anyone. Much in the same way that the land bank here is very corrupt. And I tried to make it, my writing about the land bank sort of, I shifted it to the sense that there's like bad apples in the land bank. Like my guy is the bad guy in the land bank, you know, that Charles Forrest character is like a bad guy, but
yeah,
you know,
opiates.
The land bank itself isn't bad, but
right.
You know, the land bank is pretty questionable. They do a lot of questionable things.
Opiates aside, it seems to me that if I read your series, I get the impression that land is and property is the cocaine of Nantucket.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. Yeah, it's like I wanted to use this line somewhere that I thought that, you know, Los Angeles was the greediest town in America until I came here. You know, it's like, yeah, it's all about land. You know, it's all about flipping properties and, you know. And land banks involved with it. Like, for instance, there's a property about 100 yards from where I'm sitting that the land bank has owned for a long time. It's kind of a derelict house. And a couple who own, like, I think it was 30 acres of undeveloped land on one of the ponds at the west end of the island offered to trade that land for this derelict house that they would fix up and live in. And which is technically, that's the land bank's mission, to accumulate that kind of beautiful, pristine property. They wound up selling the house for like $3 million to someone else because they were cash poor at the time.
So they missed out on acquiring 30 acres of...
Yeah, it's like that line in Deliverance where John Voight says, like, they call it the beautiful wilderness, and John Voight says, I can't believe we lost all this, and Burt Reynolds said, we didn't lose it, we sold it. You know, and that's what's, you know, there was a, Teddy Kennedy wanted to make this kind of a national monument, you know, and sort of freeze everything in the 70s, and it was voted down vociferously in town meeting, because people knew that, you know, their land was worth something, and they wanted to capitalize on it. They've been capitalizing on it ever since. You know, there's still a lot of money to be made here in real estate. And there's like $14 million houses that are selling every day, $23 million houses that are selling. You know, my girlfriend can ride around Nantucket and point to like 12 different houses that were owned by different members of her families going back to the 30s. You know, they were all sold when they were $15,000 cottages that are now $15 million mansions. You know, first thing they do with the nice old-fashioned cottages, level it, and then the big mansion comes up. So, yeah, generations of people have made fortunes here, and it's not really to the benefit of the island, I don't think. I don't think the island's a better place for that, but it's what happens.
Given that you're kind of writing about this kind of seamy side of Nantucket, what has been the response of the people there to your books?
Well, I gave my book to one customer, and he said, you better not show this to your other customers. I thought it was funny. The chief police chief thinks it's hilarious that my police chief is a poet. And he says, well, you know, it's not me. You didn't write poetry. I always make a point of saying the mistakes in the poetry are my own when I credit him for any information he may have given. Most people, though, I think, tend to think you're always talking about somebody else.
Right.
No one thinks them, you know. I mean, they see it around them, too, and they're like, you know, a lot of the people who I know are like, for instance, Annie did a yard sale at the little cottage in Pulpus, which is very much like the one where Jane lives. And the only record of that now is in my books because it's been leveled for, you know, for a new mega mansion. But in the old days, it had been the cow barn, actually, of this little farm out in Pulpus in the 19th century. And it had been adapted into this little, you know, cottage with all the beautiful prints on the wall and the things. And anyway, it rained that Saturday, so we had the yard sale inside. And this real estate agent, who was really, I think, you know, been responsible for more of the land sales that have wrecked this island than anybody else, walks in and goes, oh, I love this place. It's the old Nantucket. I just adore it. Oh, it just makes me so nostalgic. You know, really, it makes you nostalgic for the Nantucket you have been destroying since the Eisenhower administration. Whatever. Anyway, so that's funny, you know. It's like I even use that character. Elaine Bailey is the character in my books who's like the sort of primo real estate shark. And she's based on a number of people, and particularly that woman who came in and is oohing and aahing over Annie's cottage, which she, I'm sure, couldn't wait to buy up, sell, and destroy, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just, people are pretty oblivious. Like, I remember I was writing a Hollywood novel, featured a character thinly based on my crazy stepbrother, and my sister said to me, are you sure you want to write about him, you know? And he won't recognize himself. First of all, if he did recognize, he'd probably like it. You know, but it's unlikely that he would because people just don't see themselves that clearly for the most part. So, yeah, I haven't really had a lot of backlash about the worst backlash I got was on this book when my burger friend told me I'd given the wrong coloration to the Prothonotary Warbler. She was furious.
You know, I was wondering about that. You know, do you really know your Prothonotary? How do you say that?
It's spelled Prothonotary, but it's actually pronounced Prothanatory. Prothanatory Wobbler. Well, I don't know anything, but I have a burger friend who knows everything.
And you got called out on that. Well.
Oh, I tried to. I thought I wrote down exactly what she said, but obviously I got it wrong. So all the burgers are going to be after me now.
There's always the next printing. There's always the next printing.
I think I would have to be a lot more successful before they'd let me have a new printing and change the mistakes. You know, I haven't had the things that, you know, really help you on your way. I didn't get the Edgar Award or the Seamus Award or whatever, or the, you know, my books have been sort of under the radar. I guess that'll change. Hopefully, just keep writing them. Eventually, people notice them.
Yeah, I think it's a great series. I really do, and I, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think other people will as well. But it is, I understand that it's a battle to get out there.
There's a lot of books out there. One of my customers, who's a fairly prominent writer, is friendly with one of the people who reviews books at the New York Times, and has promised to get the book to that individual. So that would be huge. A review in the Times would be great. It wouldn't be a review anymore. I guess it would be like summer roundup or something. If they, just a mention in the New York Times.
Yeah.
In fact, somebody told me that a bad review in the New York Times is hugely good for sales.
Really?
Your sales jump 30% if you get a bad review in the New York Times. And I think the reason is that suddenly you exist.
Right.
You know what I mean? You suddenly exist. And I've read many reviews in the New York Times where they claimed the writer was good and thought the quotes were bad. And many reviews in the New York Times where they thought the writing was bad, and I was like, that's actually pretty good. So you don't always agree with the reviewer, and then you know that the book exists. And I think that so anything, any scrap of attention to the New York Times would be huge for me.
Sure. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who just cruise the first, paragraph of a review and just glean a little thing and say, oh, kind of file that away. Oh, yeah, Stephen Axelrod has this series on Nantucket. That sounds kind of interesting. No matter what
Nantucket,
they said afterward,
cool.
It's lodged in someone's brain.
Yeah, just getting in there is the hugest thing, even if it's negative, not that it necessarily would be, but I don't even care. Just notice me.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get noticed. I have a friend who's a wonderful writer who writes sort of like some kind of weird combination of, if you can imagine Borges or Calvino writing science fiction novels, or fantasy novels, that's the way this guy writes. Just amazing. But because of that, the people who read Borges and Calvino aren't interested in science fiction. And science fiction readers are like, what the hell is this? So he's always on to the gap. And we were commiserating, and he was like, it's hard to get people to read a book. Which is, it's especially, he's a much better writer than me, so it's especially frustrating that he has these problems. But it's hard. There's just a lot of books out there.
Yeah.
Like Marilyn Stasio, who is not the critic I'm thinking of, but she is the primary crime fiction critic for the New York Times. I think every other week she has a column, features like four books. So, you can do the math and figure she reviews about 100 books a year, something like that, out of the thousands that come out. So, just to get Marilyn Stasio to notice you, even if she's lukewarm, is huge. But, it's just there's so few outlets now. There's not that many reviewers that anyone really reads. So the Times looms ever larger. Like Ben Brantley, the theater critic, he can just kill a play. That's always been the case, but it still is. Whether, the New York Times theater critic, boom, you get a pan from them and it's over. Or you get a rave and suddenly you've got new life, So it's a little scary to think. It must be weird to be him and that you have that much power, actual power over actual people's lives, At least with the book, it's just me, and I'm just pecking the thing away. Broadway play, there's hundreds of people whose employment you're jeopardizing if you don't like it. It must be, I'd be nervous about that. But anyway.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and I did want to talk a little bit about writing and technique. And in an email, you mentioned that you'd like to talk about the difference between found and bespoke clues in a mystery.
Sure. Well, actually, the thing I read to you is a classic example of a found clue. Like, people say, well, how do you make up your plots and all that kind of thing? The plots are fairly easy to make up. Somebody gets killed and somebody did it and someone else didn't. But the real hard thing in these kind of books is the clues, the actual pieces of information that turn the plot. Because there's certain requirements for a clue. It has to be something that looks one way and really is something else, or whose significance is concealed in some way. So you're always looking for things in life that have that kind of duality to them. A good example is I was painting the guy's house, actually the guy who said to me, you better not show this book to the rest of your customers. And he has an enormous pergola in his house, which is a series of boards that go above a deck. I guess if you put like some kind of sheathing over them, it would be a roofed deck, but it's like an open roof deck with the boards showing. And because the top of it is visible from the second floor of the house, we had to paint the top. And I went into the house to be sure the paint job looked okay. And I went into his study, where there was like three walls of windows, and I opened the wooden Venetian blinds to check. And they looked fine, so I closed the Venetian blinds and I was leaving. And Annie's sister, Robin, who was painting with me, said to me, "You closed the Venetian blinds wrong." And I was like, "How do you close Venetian blinds wrong?" He's like, "It's like, no, they're all closed slats down, and you closed those slats up." And I looked and I saw she was right. And I thought, that's a found clue. I thought, you know, that's the kind of thing, the way my mind works, I can use that. Because if I was Henry and I walked in that room, I would know someone had been in there and been looking out that window. But what makes a found clue so interesting is that now you have a room and a guy and something that he's looking at that you never had before. In other words, you build the story around the found clue. That's why it's found. You know what I mean? It's like, so suddenly you need all these things you didn't know about. You have to fit these new things into your book, which makes kind of a randomizing element to it that makes it really fun. A bespoke clue is different. You know, bespoke clue is something like, I need something that will work in this situation. You know, I need to find something that would fit what needs to be done. You kind of like tailor it to the situation. And those are good, but they don't have the kind of freshness that the found clues do. The found clues kind of set you off in different... Yeah, you have to work for them, and the work is kind of pedestrian. Like, here's a good example of a bespoke clue. And this isn't something this is just randomly selected, but I had a story where there were two brothers, and one of them had gone undercover with a terrorist organization, and they thought he'd kind of gone over, so his brother went to bail him out, and his brother gets him out, but it turns out he actually has become a terrorist. And I needed something, and the brother figures it out. And I needed some way for the brother to sort of figure that out. So I decided it would be that the guy had a flag tattoo, but that he burned the flag tattoo off when he became a terrorist. And now he has like those stick-on tattoos that you use. Uh-huh. So in case anybody, in case he was with someone who knew him or he wanted to continue to present himself as a good American patriot, he could always just put that flag tattoo on and it would look like nothing was different. And in fact, his brother noticed the flag tattoo, but he also noticed it coming off, because those things curl and wear off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So his brother sees that, he realizes that it's a stick-on and not the real thing anymore, and that's how he figures out that the guy's turned. And, you know, that's okay, it works, but it doesn't have the freshness of the slats, because that just... you know, came to me. That was just given to me. Another one from this book, there are a lot of found clues in Nantucket Grand. I was my burger friend who gives me the information. I saw her one day and she was soaking wet. And I was like, what the heck? It was a sunny day. I was like, what happened? And she said, well, it was raining in Nantucket. And I was like, really? It was raining in Nantucket and sunny here. You know, mid-island sunny, west end of the island rain. She's like, that happens all the time. I'm like, cool.
You can geolocate.
In other words, I'm immediately thinking, oh, well, someone says they were in Nantucket, but their jacket was dry. You know what I mean?
Sure.
That's like, that's death of an alibi. Boom. You know. So I love it when those things, one just happened yesterday, actually. And I have no idea how I'm going to use this, but there's a lot of oak pollen everywhere on Nantucket right now, yellow oak pollen, and it's just drifting. And I was talking to this carpenter, and he said, well, the oak pollen's fine, but I'm trying to think what the plant is. There's some other plant that has yellow pollen around here that won't come out of your clothes. If you get on, it stains permanently. And I thought, oh, my God, well, that's perfect. You know, I don't know how I'm going to use it, but, you know, it's like, it's one of those things that a little difference like that is something I can use. Now I need pollen. I don't know where I'm going to put it, but, like, another thing that just occurred to me, we have 825 numbers and 325 numbers on Nantucket. And I made a mistake calling somebody because the last four digits were the same, but the first three weren't. And then I thought, oh, the 3 and the 8 are identical. If you only look at the right-hand side. If you just look one side of an 8, it could be a 3.
So right. I'm now going to be officially looking for those in your next book.
Yeah.
Anyways,
it's interesting. Those are the things that shape the book, really. You know.
Yeah.
They shape the book.
Absolutely. Well, I'm hoping there'll be some people. Maybe you just gave away secrets to your competition, but I'm hoping.
I know. Oh no.
We'll find that.
Well, good luck with them, because you have to find a way to use that pollen in a way that makes sense. You know, that's the hard part.
Right.
It's like they're like, wait a second, what the, you know, and then. That's why they feel so fresh, because they force you to think. And there's one of, going back to Glover again, our erstwhile professor, he always had this thought that he had a thought that he often presented, that form creates content. And it, like, he was fond of discussing the but construction, where a but in a sentence is like a right angle. I say, you know, Gary Miller was a terrific guy, but.
Absolutely.
And you're like, but what?
Please don't finish that sentence.
Well, that's the point, though. I've got to finish that sentence somehow. Suddenly, I'm coming up with something, you know, and much in the same way, a thing like those slats, they're just there. They're just a phenomenon of, like, somebody closing some Venetian blinds wrong. But it forces you to think about who could have done it and why and where and what it signifies. So you're forced to think in a different way. You expand your thinking, and the book becomes more alive, I think, because you're doing things, you're off the track of where you thought you were, and you're making a new track for yourself that you didn't expect, which makes it, I think, more interesting.
It feels more alive
when you write it, and I think it comes through in the writing too when you read it.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that in the email, because it was totally worth talking about. Anyway, Stephen Axelrod, we are at the end of our time here on Write the Book today, but I really appreciate your coming on to talk about Nantucket Grand, which is out now on Poison Pen Press, a fantastic third entry in the Henry Kennis Mystery Series. And thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Stephen Axelrod, author of Nantucket Grand, the third in his Henry Kennis Mystery Series, set on Nantucket and published by Poison Pen Press. You can find it at your local independent bookseller. For more information about the series, visit poisonpenpress.com. Stephen Axelrod provided a great writing exercise for this week, and this is what he wrote. I've been thinking about writing exercises. The best one I know is also the simplest and most useful. Step 1, write 1,000 words or so, story or memoir, something that you care about and has an emotional connection. Step 2, cut it down to 750 words. Step 3, cut the 750 words down to 500. See what's left. If the essence remains, you've succeeded, and at half the length. In his prompt, Axelrod quotes E.B. White, "Sorry this was so long, I didn't have time to make it shorter." Thanks for listening to Write the Book. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at the website of Write the Book host Shayla Shapiro. And that website is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. The theme song for this episode of Write the Book is by Possum. You can find them on Facebook. And I'm Gary Lee Miller, and you can find more out about me at GaryLeeMiller.com. I'm looking forward to more great book talk, and I hope you'll be here to join me. This has been Write the Book, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
It's a hard story with a soft cover. Every heart is double spaced for bookmarks. conquer. Say what you want, I'll disagree. I could write a book.
He could write a book
about me. Yeah, I could write a book.
He could write a book.